Good afternoon, everyone. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everyone. First things first, if you have a cell phone or other electronic device, please turn it off during the meeting. And I'd like to begin with a moment of silence in memory of all the recoveries that AA has accomplished in the last 70 years. And the format of this meeting is that we will have three speakers, each of whom will speak for approximately 20 minutes. And I'll say this one more time for those who've come in late. I realize there may be someone here who's waiting for notice that the team has harvested the organ for your transplant surgery. If that's not you, please turn off your cell phone. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our first speaker, who's going to speak on the topic today of gratitude in your attitude. And it's Arlene P. from Florida. Let's give her a warm welcome.
I just want to, first of all, my name is Arlene and I'm an alcoholic. Just cannot believe I'm here. It's just like a dream. I'm a member of the Sweet Tomatoes and Bay Group in Sarasota, Florida. And the Steel Magnolias and the Norwell New Hope in Norwell, Massachusetts. Yay. And it was funny, the word gratitude, I said, oh dear, you know, where do I begin with that? Because I am such a grateful alcoholic. And my daughter went to an acupuncturist 2 weeks ago, and she came home and she said the acupuncturist made her write down the one word to best describe her. And she wrote down grateful. And the acupuncturist says, gee, that's an odd word. I didn't expect you to be writing down grateful. Where did this come from? And she said it came from my mother. She's the most grateful person I know. So maybe this is what my higher power had in mind. I just like to always say that alcohol always had a special meaning to me. When I was 5 years old, my Baptist grandmother would get me on my knees by the side of the bed and would ask the good Lord up in heaven to keep this child away from wine and cigarettes and alcohol and men. Sort of like I'm doing nowadays, but anyway. Anyway, I was 5 years old, you know, and I thought, well, I don't have a problem with alcohol because that's that stuff you put on when you cut your hand and that stings. And I was having a problem with a man at that point. My uncle at this time was sexually molesting me. So I really knew that I didn't want to go around men. So there were the two things that started me off. When I was 7 years old, my mother, who I had never met, and a stepfather, who I'd never met, came down to Delaware, where I was so happy, other than what was going on there, and they moved me from Delaware up to New Jersey. And it was that time that my new stepfather began to sexually molest me. And I think over the years, I look back, and I've been told by my counselor that I have had several nervous breakdowns. And I can remember being 7 years old, and I was under the fire escape at the school, and I wouldn't go into the classroom. And I look back, and, you know, at that time, there was no title for it, just that she wasn't behaving, or this, that, and the other. And I always think at that point I was having a breakdown. So my parents took me to a doctor who gave me a thorough examination, who then reported to them that I had been sexually molested, and I couldn't tell anybody it was my new stepfather, so I blamed it all on my uncle. And with that, the alcoholic doctor came to live with us, and he sexually molested me. So I was really, really, really an accident about to happen. I was a sad, sad little girl, and I had this terrible knot in my stomach, And I used to ask that dear good Lord, that Baptist good Lord, to please let me die. Please let me die. And I would be so disappointed when I'd wake up in the morning and thinking, he really doesn't answer prayers. Well, I went on, and I went into nurse's training, and moved. Things were really, really bad at my house. My mother was the alcoholic, and my father was whatever label you want to put on it, he was. And you know what it's like to be a little girl in an alcoholic home where, you know, promises are made and not kept, and turkeys fly after they've been cooked for Thanksgiving, and Christmas trees come down when they're if they've even been put up. So I was always, always disturbed and sad, and I was always, always crying. So I went away to nurse's training and graduated from nurse's training and still had that whole feeling of where do I belong and what do I do. So I got into my little Corvair, red Corvair, and I drove up to the Mass General Hospital, which I couldn't even get there now, by myself at 20 years old, and went to work at the Mass General. And at this point, I had never touched alcohol because I said, I will never, ever, ever become what my mother was. I will never, never drink. So I was in the hospital, and I had this little handsome patient of mine. And he was, like, smooth, you know, like I was from the country. And he was like street kid. He was like smooth. He had the tattoo and the butt hanging out of his mouth and everything. And he'd say to me all the time, I'm going to marry you. I'm going to marry you. And I'd think, oh, my God. And the women were coming in and out of the hospital room and practically climbing in bed with them. And I thought, oh, what a character this person is. But you know what? And he would chase me around in this wheelchair, and he kept saying, I'm going to marry you. And I thought he was like crazy. So anyway, see where he was streetwise and I was like naive, he called me up and asked me he needed a ride to the doctor's. And I said, why? He said, nobody can take me and I know you have a kind heart and blah, blah, blah. Will you pick me up and drive me to the doctor's? So I picked him up and I drove him to the doctor's and we were getting married 19 days later. And you know what? I married a human being, you know, and he couldn't do for me what I've learned that only my God in Alcoholics Anonymous was able to do. And I had that knot in my stomach again. So I married him, and he had an all-Italian family. And they would drink on the holidays, and they would sing, they'd pinch your cheeks, and they would do all that. And I thought, you know, why am I afraid of alcohol? You know, I've written step one, pain has no memory. And I thought, you know, why am I so afraid of it? Because look at Mundo, Guido, Jojo. Now, what do? They all laugh, and they take little naps, and they're fun. So my husband said, am I screaming? My husband said to me, you know, Arlene, maybe you need a little bit of that wine. And it will help you out. And I said, oh, no, I don't think so. I'm afraid of it. And I'd always like to say, you don't have to drink alcohol to suffer from alcoholism. And I was already suffering for 23 years with this disease, and I hadn't yet to pick up a drink. So he said, well, just have a little taste. And he poured this little drink of Chianti in this little glass, and I put it up to my lips, and I went, oh, my God, why did I wait all these years for this? It got right down into that little knot. It got right down into that little spot, and I felt so good. And I said, well, give me some more. And he got a kick out of it, you know. And so with that, I wanted to get my own. Now, my husband traveled all the time, and the children were starting to come, but now I'm into this drinking, and I am so excited. Because I was very lonely up in New England. You know, the New Englanders, they didn't talk to you in the supermarket, and they didn't, you know, come on over, and they didn't do any of that. And so I was very, very lonely. So anyway, I'd be going down to the liquor store. Now, my kids were coming at this point, and I'd get down to the liquor store, and I'd say, oh, I'll try one of those. And maybe one of those. And I put them in the baby carriage and tuck them under the carriage and walk back home. And I was all excited. And I couldn't wait. I'd be looking at the clock. If I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about it. 7.5 more hours and I can drink because, you know, good mothers did not drink. So anyway, my husband would come home every once in a while from a trip and he'd say to me, but why are all these bottles hanging all around the house with these vines in them? And I said, oh, they're my little Chianti bottles. And he said, what about the one with the big yellow, with the yellow stuff in it? And I said, oh, that's Galliano. And I said, and oh, this one over here you put over ice cream? I said, this is so wonderful. I had found my best friend, and I couldn't wait. And every day I was thinking, which shall I have today, and which bottle shall I buy? And it was wonderful. And from what I understand, I was just wonderful too when I drank. I was the Betty Crocker in the kitchen. I was the sensuous woman after 11, which you can't tell me that today. And I was the chauffeur, and I was just everything. And things were going around good, and alcohol was my best. Okay. It was my best friend, and I was really, really excited. Well, things started to happen where I became the Betty Crocker in the kitchen, the sensual woman in the kitchen. I mean, the Betty Crocker in the bedroom and the sensual woman in the kitchen, and things were getting out of control. We were way getting out of control. And my husband would always come home and he'd say, do you think you're drinking too much? I said, absolutely not. I said, if it wasn't for drinking, you know what? We wouldn't have what we have now, because I'm a whole new person. But you know what? Deep inside, that little knot was starting to come again. And deep inside, I was getting a little bit afraid. And deep inside, I thought, oh, my God, maybe, no, I can't have a problem with this. So I said, I know what I'll do. I'll get religion. I will become a Catholic. And I learned all those rosaries. And I knew all those mysteries, and I went to Mass, and I went to confession, and I did everything, and I got drunk. And I said, well, it worked for my Catholic girlfriends. They don't drink too much. Well, I know what I knew. I need the Baptist religion, because that's where it started. I need to know the Bible and really get into that. So I signed up for a Baptist Bible study in Hingham. And I began to read the Bible. And I would be reading the Bible at night, and I would be drunk, and my husband would look over at me, and I'd say, this and thou, and oh, these are the Beatitudes. And so anyway, I did all that Bible study, and I got drunk. So then I said, well, what I really need is transcendental meditation. They really got it. So I signed up for that, and I got real friendly with the Maharishi, and I was sitting cross-legged, and I was humming my mantra. And my kids were getting big by now, and they would look in. She's doing it again. She's still doing it. I'm sorry, Aunt Joan, she can't come to the phone. She's meditating. You know, and so I did all of that, and I got drunk. So now what was I going to do? What was I going to do? My religion didn't help me, and reading the Bible didn't help me, and going to TM didn't help me with this problem. So anyway, it was sometime in February, and my husband was standing here. My three children were seated there, and I was holding on to the sink, and I was dry heaving. I had my head in the sink, and I was holding like this, and my hands were shaking. I looked at my husband, I looked at my kids, and he said to me, this has got to stop. And I said, I know it does. And he said, no, I mean it this time. This has got to stop. And I looked at those three dear little faces and knew they didn't deserve this, and I said, if I don't drink, Ken, I will die. He said, then die. And I got ready to die. I got ready to die. Prior to this, I had gone to Al-Anon, getting my stories mixed up. I had gone to Al-Anon, and I got, because that was what was wrong with me, and tell you the truth, that was a lot what was wrong with me. So anyway, I got there at Al-Anon, and I met all these women who I could not stand. I didn't like women anyway, and they were all like in a group, and they would come over and they'd say, do you want my number? I thought, no, I don't. Will you give me your number? I'll call you. I don't want you to call me. We're all getting together Friday to bake cookies at Pat's. Who the hell cares what you're doing? I didn't like them. I didn't want them. But God bless them, these Al-Anon people. You know, I know today they could see right on through me. So I did the program in Al-Anon like I did in AA. I got a sponsor. I joined a group. I got into the steps. And I was active and drinking. And shaking and drinking and going to Al-Anon. And one night in Marshfield on a Tuesday night, we were taking this moral and fearful inventory. And I think this was another one of my nervous breakdowns. I read it and I said, oh my God, don't tell me I'm an alcoholic. Don't tell me that I have become the thing I hate most in life. Don't tell me I'm an alcoholic mother, an alcoholic wife, an alcoholic person. Because that is the last thing in the world that I ever wanted. You know, when my Baptist grandmother and I were down on our knees, she didn't say, "Dear Lord, let this child grow up to be a fat alcoholic." You know, this was not what I had planned. But alcoholism had a grip on me, and I no longer was drinking because I wanted to. I was no longer drinking for the knot in my stomach. I was drinking because I had to. And from the time I was 23 until the time I was 39, I never went one day without drinking. Every single day of my life. And every single day I would say, you know, my kids don't deserve this, but I didn't know what else to do. So after that day, he said to me, "Di," I walked into the Norwell Monday night meeting, ready to die. Because he didn't know what he was asking of me, because I just knew I couldn't live with all these feelings that I had put down so deep. And they were so painful. I walked into the Norwell Monday night meeting, and I see a woman that I recognize from town. A beautiful woman with her little diamond earrings, little Pendleton wool outfit. And she, "Hello." Say hi. And this woman has the nerve to send me this little note on the raffle ticket. "Alcoholism is a disease that tells you you don't have a disease." What the shit was she sending that to me for, you know? I mean, really. So anyway, being a little Baptist, charismatic, Catholic, Maharishi person, I wouldn't dare do this, but I wanted to do that. Yeah, give her. But anyway, I said, "Hi." So she came over after the meeting, and she said to me, "Are you having a problem with alcohol?" I said, "No way. I'm having a problem with an Italian mother-in-law who hates Irish daughter-in-laws. I'm having trouble with my mother who is an alcoholic. I am having trouble with my father sexually abusing me. I'm having trouble with the neighbors in New England. I'm having trouble with all these kids. I'm having all kinds of trouble." And she says, "Good, I'll pick you up in the morning and we'll go to a meeting." I thought, well, why? But you know what? The grace of God, I think I was sort of letting in at that point, because why would I go out that next morning, hungover, hanging on to the railing, walking down the steps, dry heaving, and there she would sit in the car, and I would get into that car, and she took me to a meeting day after day after day after day, and I couldn't stop drinking. I had gotten a group, I'd gotten a sponsor, I'd gotten into the steps, and I couldn't stop drinking. So anyway, talk about Skid Row is not a place that's a state of mind. And I was in Skid Row, and I didn't think I was ever going to be able to do this. So this woman that kept coming, I said to my husband, "Listen, if that woman calls again, tell her I'm not here." And he'd say, "Just a minute, Marianne." So then I said, "Well, you don't know what she does. She runs around every night with a bunch of men in cars, and they're telling their stories, the secrets of their lives. They're telling them in Boston and then down the Cape and all." And I said, "You want me to get in a car with her and drive around and tell my secrets?" And he'd say, "Yes." So now I figured my husband and my girlfriend were having an affair, that he was trying to drive me crazy. So one time I pick up the phone, and I get so mad, I yank the phone out of it. "Hello, would you like to go to a meeting?" "Of course I don't want to go to a meeting. Why would I want to go to a meeting?" She said, "I'll be there in a half an hour." But anyway, I kept going, and I was scared because I couldn't get it. June 18th of 1979, I was at the Hanover Swim and Tennis Club, and everybody was having fun. And I said, "Well, you have to have gin and tonics on a day like this. It was Father's Day, and it was hot." So I went home, and I got my cooler, and I got my gin, and I got my tonic, and got my limes, and I took it all down to the club. Nobody wanted to drink. The hell? Nobody wants to drink. So I say, "Oh, dear." So I bring it back home. I had not drank for 3 days at this point. I came back home, and I went to pour the gin back in the bottle, and I started to lick it, and I drank the whole thing right down. And the last thing I can remember that June 18th of 1979 was my husband. And he said, "Arlene, my God, have you been drinking?" And I said, "You bet your ass I have." And I woke up in the morning with my apron and my sneakers on in one of my kids' beds. And that's the way it gone. But that morning on June 18th, I don't know if it was another meeting, another prayer, another surrender, another step. I don't know what happened, but I didn't drink. I didn't drink. And that was 18 years, and I didn't drink that day. And I cried so hard that morning because I didn't drink. Now, you know, I believe in the Catholic Charismatic. I love them. I believe in the Baptists. I love them. I even like Maharishi. But, you know, I had to come in here to find the God that works for me under all conditions. I had to come in here and find the faith that you people in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me about. I came in and I was so grateful that I didn't drink, that I would cry some days. Did my husband say, why are you crying? I said, because I didn't drink. I didn't drink. I just want to tell you one story. My sponsor then said to me I could go on my own to find some meetings. And I thought, bulldog, you know what I mean? I mean, she's been driving me every day. Now she wants me to find my own meeting. Well, I'll show her. And I got my list out. It was the Scituate Women's Meeting, discussion meeting in Scituate. And I'll show her. And I got in my car. And I went to the meeting. And all these women, looking really spiffy, by the way, looking good. At this point, I was still wearing my mother-in-law's underwear, my husband's jacket, and my kid's socks coming out the back of my Dockside, you know what I mean, and polyester, and oh, Lord. And I walked in there, and there were all these Miss Pendleton wools with the diamonds in there. And so I sat at the meeting, and I was crying, because this is all I did for 2 years. I just cried and cried and cried. So I'm sitting in this meeting, and I finally get up, and I have the nerve to say, what kind of a meeting is this anyway? No one welcomed me. No one extended their hand. No one said welcome. Nobody did anything. What is this meeting? They said, it's the Hingham Women's Real Estate Meeting. I have a couple of other meetings that I went to like that, but we're limited with the time. And all I can say is I wanted it now. I wanted it so badly. So this woman, I was in a meeting one night, and this woman, much like myself, got up, and she said, if you don't have a sponsor, before you leave here tonight, give yourself the best gift you could ever have and get a sponsor. So I turned to this Miss Pendleton Wool with the diamond rings, and I didn't like it. And I said, listen, Marianne, will you be my sponsor until I can get a good one? Seriously, because she was not my type, not at all. I needed a little fat redhead with, you know. And she said, as that type of a woman would answer, I'd be delighted. So with that, we started to go, and she said, the first thing you have to do is get into the steps. And I cannot tell you, I've been in the steps for 26 years. I never, never, never go without my steps. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to not to drink. But the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to live. It taught me that I had to forgive myself. And I had to forgive those three men that I never thought I would forgive. And because I asked my higher power, I was able to do that. For me, forgiveness is not an option. It is absolutely essential for me to be sober. But I do know that my God did that. Many years later, I was in therapy, and the therapist was trying to get me. I had another little breakdown, you know, it's the childhood stuff, and here she goes again. And I ended up in therapy, and the therapist said, where's this anger? Where's this anger? Where is it? And I said, at the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had gotten rid of it. I had gotten rid of it. And it is such a miracle. So I got into the steps, and I sought my higher power in step 11, and I made amends, and I took my inventory, and I became willing, and it's a lot of hard work, but this is where the journey began for me, and into the steps. I got a group, I got a sponsor, and you know, it was funny, I asked her last night, because she's here with me, I said to her, will you still be my sponsor until I got a good one, because I've had her for 26 years, and I think I have absolutely the best. So anyway, life went on, and I always say, if you want to know how your sobriety is, ask the people that live with you. You know, this little Baptist girl down on her knees at 5 years old, all she wanted to do was to be a good mother, a good wife, a good friend. That was all I wanted to do. And because of alcohol, I wasn't able to do it. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am able to do it. Ask my husband, ask my children, ask my grandchildren. I went golfing last Monday with my grandchild, and of course I cry easily, and I'm just about crying. He says, Brandy, are you crying? And I said, a little bit. And he said, but why? I said, I'm happy, you know, because whoever ever dreamed, you know, that 27 years ago I'd be golfing with my grandson. I absolutely love, love, love this program. I love my two groups. I love my sponsor. I love the kids, the girls, the little girls, the little squash blossoms that we sponsor. And I love you people. And I to end it up, as to quote my friend Edie, she said, it all began when I walked into the halls of AA and said,
Hello. My name is Arlene, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Arlene. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce our second speaker, Evelyn from New Jersey. Let's give her a warm welcome.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Evelyn, and I am a very, very grateful alcoholic. I'm very grateful to be here. And I'm especially grateful because for the first time in 33 years, I got thrown out of an AA meeting. I was upstairs in one of the meetings and the door was, the monitor, whoever they were outside. And they said, well, nobody else can get in the meeting. The meeting is full. So, of course, you know, I'm a dope fiend and alcoholic. And I saw in the other door where they said the arrow was pointing go there. So I saw a little crack, so I pushed in, of course, and went in and sat down. And I'm sitting down, I'm getting into the meeting. Next thing I know, somebody touches me on my shoulder. You gotta go. I said, I can't believe they're kicking me out of an AA meeting here. But I'm grateful to be here. Very grateful. And old habits do die hard. As I said before, my name is Evelyn, and I'm a very, very grateful alcoholic. And being Evelyn is incidental. I called myself an alcoholic from the time that I first tasted a drink. And I called myself an alcoholic because I knew that was the way I could get you or somebody to buy me a drink. If I went in and out of bars and said that I was an alcoholic, I was sure that somebody was going to give me a drink, and that's how I used to get my drinks. I started drinking. I live in New Jersey now, but by way of Harlem, USA. I was born and bred in Harlem. And I didn't come from an alcoholic family. I'm an only child. I look like my father. Anything I ever wanted in life, if they could afford to give it to me, they gave it to me. They loved me to death. I think they had one stillborn child before I was born, and they were in their 30s when I was born, and they just loved me to death. I never saw my father smoke a cigarette. I never saw my father take a drink. My mother used to drink very socially every now and then. So I didn't come from an alcoholic family. All the shit that I learned and all the stuff that I did, I learned being out there in the streets, okay? I can't blame it on a dysfunctional family. Nobody molested me. Nobody did nothing to me. I was loved, loved, loved. If I could have only learned to love myself the way my mother and father and the people in my community loved me, I probably would not be standing here in front of you today. But being a very... Well, first of all, my parents died, and I can't even blame it on that, because in those days, if a family member died, there wasn't any DIFAS if you come from New Jersey or CSW if you come, no state. You simply went to live with a family member. It was unheard of that you would go into foster care, or if you had a large family and somebody in the family died, then another family member just took you in those days. So I went to live across the street with a first cousin of mine, my mother's sister's daughter. Now, in her house, they drank on the weekends. And it was interesting because I had never seen drinking weekends or no other kind. But on the weekdays, I would have to be upstairs at 8 o'clock. Like I said, I lived in Harlem in a very close-knit community. And on the weekends, I could stay downstairs until about 11. Laura Mae, which is the woman I went to live with, was a weekend warrior. She was a weekend drinker. She would start drinking on Friday nights, And they would order, I never forget it, J.W. Dan's or Calvitz, and they would each put in a dollar. It would be about six or seven of them. They would each put in a dollar. They never put in more than a dollar, just enough to get the runner to come from the liquor store up to the house. And when they finished that pint, they would all put in another dollar, and they would get another fifth or another pint. They never bought two pints. They never bought two fifths. It was always just enough. And I used to say, I didn't know whether they didn't have no more money or they couldn't count past a dollar or what the hell it was. But that was the way it was. And the runner was coming all night long. As they would finish one pint, then he would come with another pint. They finished that pint, he would come with another pint. On the weekdays, like I said, I had to be upstairs at 9:30. On the weekdays, when Lorme took a drink, I could stay downstairs until like 11, 12 o'clock, which was unheard of in those days for a 12 or 11-year-old to stay downstairs that long. She would take the drink. Well, on the weekdays, we would listen to Dr. Jive or just some music, some soft music or the news. On the weekends, when Lorme would get drunk, she would put on this West Indian music and put her dress up above her knees and call me boopy and this and that. And she had like a whole personality just took on the chat. I used to love it. I said, whatever she's drinking, I wish she drank it all week long. You know, not just on the weekends, but I was able to have my way. Me and my girlfriend decided one weekend, and this is my first drink, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. We decided that we were going to taste what it was that she had in that bottle. Whatever it was that they were drinking that was making her change, we decided we would do it. So we put some in the bottle, and we drank it down, and we held on to the kitchen table. Laverne is holding on, and I'm holding on. I didn't know what the hell to drink, what it was from, because I knew she, like, changed up on me when she drank, you know? And I'm holding on, and Laverne, and it burnt going down, and I looked at them, and I said, well, do you feel anything? She said, no, it burnt going down. I said, well, what is the big deal with this thing? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I lived on the sixth floor in a walk-up. By the time I got downstairs, Benny King was, used to be a little jukebox joint on the corner. And Benny King was playing up on the roof, and the Drifters was saying, and I heard this music like I had never heard it before. Bells was going off in my head. I felt like I was on Park Avenue and 68th Street instead of 119th Street and Park Avenue. And I mean, it was, I said, wow. And I loved it. I loved the way it made me feel. I loved the way it made me, opened me up. And I loved it so much until I said, I ain't going to tell Laverne how much I love this. See, I became an alcoholic right then. Right away, I became cheap. I became greedy. I became a hoarder. And I was like 12, 13 years old. And I was busy trying to not act like it made me feel as good as it made me feel, because I didn't know when we could get any more. And I damn sure didn't want Laverne to have no more. You see, I wanted it all for myself from that point in. And that's the way I drank. I drank as if every single drink was the last drop on the face of the earth. I had an insatiable appetite for alcohol. It never burned my, I could drink straight rum without Coke. I could drink straight vodka without orange juice. It never burned my throat. I used to hear people say, oh, it burns going down. It never burned my throat going down. The more it burned, the more I'd say, You know, I knew I was going to feel good. And this was the way I drank. I was to later, we started buying wine. I became a 12, 13-year-old wino, sitting in the park waiting for somebody to come by to go into the liquor store so that they could buy us some wine. We'd have, five of us would be on a Campbell's cigarette, smoking a cigarette. Five of us would be on a pint. Nobody had money for cups. And I was always interested, always the one that was interested in how long was this person holding the bottle. See, when the pint got to me, I would just chug-a-lug it down. When it got to somebody else, I'm looking at them, well, how long are you going to hold the damn bottle? You know, now, how long, what you going to do here? You know, turn it loose. But when it got to me, I forgot that everybody else was around. And this is the way I drank. When I was old enough to go in the bars, and I grew up wanting to be, you see, I come from an era and from a time when gangsterism was big deal. I thought I was Miss Nikki Barnes. My husband thought he was Mr. Nikki Barnes. And we was out there just doing our thing and thought that we had it like that. When I got old enough to go into the bars, to be able to drink without having to look over my shoulder to see if any of the neighbors was around, to be able to smoke a cigarette, I thought I had arrived. I'd go in that funky 3-for-1 bar, have them lined up 3, 6, 9, 12, and I was in seventh heaven. I was a blackout drinker. I would get in the bar, leave the bar, get in a cab. I lived on 148th Street and Broadway. I'd get in the car. The next thing I know, I'm way up on I'm in the Bronx, up in Riverdale someplace, 240-something Street. The wig is gone. The shoe is gone. I done peed 2-3 times in the back of the man's cab. Then I don't want to pay him. I don't want to pay him nothing. He's driving me to the police precinct. I'm standing in front of the police precinct. I done lost my wig, my hair all braided up. I'm looking, and one of the police captains said, "Well, my God, put a bag or something on her head. Do something with her, you know?" And I was forever getting into trouble. And this was day in and day out, day in and day out, you know? And it was a way of life. You see, when I look at my life today, and it's interesting that we're talking on gratefulness and gratitude, the way I live today is so totally alien from the way I lived back then. It's a difference of night and day. I was the kind of drunk that the minute I get drunk, I could be sitting in the bar or sitting at a nightclub with you. I've known these girls and guys for years. The minute that liquor hit me, "Yeah, well, bitch, you said this in 1957. In 1957, you did this or you did that. Now I want to curse you out. I want to fight. I want to do all kinds of things." And people don't even know what I'm talking about. You know? They say, "Well, Evelyn, what's wrong with you? Well, you know, what you talking about? Yeah, I remember when you said this in 1952, and then you said this, and now I'm ready to fight." And then I'd get up and leave. I'd be way out in Long Island somewhere. I never left Harlem when I was drinking. I didn't know how to even get past 125th Street. I would go out with these people, get drunk with them, then I'm going to leave them like I know where I'm going. And I'm walking up and down Northern Boulevard or someplace else, and I don't know where the hell I'm at. And here they are trying to come get me, and I'm standing in the street. I'm cursing them out. But I also had I always love to be the bad person. I never wanted to be a good person. I always wanted to be I love James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart. I wanted to be a gangster's mall and rob banks and do all that kind of shit. I love that stuff, you know. I always wanted to be that. So, you know, when I was a little girl and my mother's friends used to ask me, "Well, what do you want to be when you grow up?" And I'd look at them like this. "What do you mean what I want?" I didn't know what I wanted to be. Some of my little girlfriends would say, "Well, we want to be a nurse and a doctor and this, that, and the other." I ain't never want to be none of that. I ain't never wanted to be nothing but getting out there in the street, putting on clothes, sitting in the bar, having a cigarette, walking into the bar and having everybody say, "Here's Evie." I love that. See, I love that. I wanted to be the biggest gun mall and whatnot. And it was insane. I learned how to curse when I was like 6 years old. I used to get in the mirror in my bathroom and I used to hear grown people curse and I would just let them roll off my life. I just curse and say all kind of curse words and whatnot, practicing how I'm gonna curse when I get out there in the street. You know? Love to curse. And when I got to be about 15 or 16, I'd be somewhere drunk and somebody would mess with one of my friends and they'd come wake me up out of a black eye. "Evelyn, wake up. Go curse him out for me. Go tell him off. Curse him out for me." I knew words that hadn't even been invented yet when I was a teenager. growing up under this, and I can't blame it on Harlem. I used to say, well, I grew up in an environment when I hit AA. They brought me to AA in 1969, 1968. And I said, I looked around. I must have been about 22 years old. I said, you got to be kidding. I said, these people here are old enough to be my great-grandmothers and fathers. Ain't no way in the world. I said, I'm going to be the only person on 7th Avenue and Lenox Avenue on the weekend who's sober. I said, you want me to be the only person in Harlem sober? I ain't coming back. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you, it was either I was in the hospital for drinking or I was in the hospital for getting my ass kicked by my husband. I was either getting beat up, I was a battered wife, or I was in the hospital for drinking. And so when I made my last hospitalization, well, my next to last hospitalization. See, it was a crazy scene. It was, we were into selling drugs. We were into doing drugs. We were into drinking. And when I'd be in the back room drinking and everybody else would be in my kitchen, mask on, bagging up dope and doing this, I'd wake up and get drunk. And I said, I'm sick. I need to go to hospital. So I get on the phone in the back room and call 911. Well, when you call 911, the police comes first. The first people that come is the police. Now, everybody is in my front room, mounting the heroin and cocaine and this, that, and the other. And I'm back there. Y'all got to come and get me. I'm sick. I got to go to the hospital. And here come the police. Okay? So I can't tell you how many times my husband put me out or beat me up or whatever the case might be. I was in Metropolitan Hospital for detox. Well, I wasn't in there for detox. They didn't have no detox in those days. They would put me in there because I didn't eat when I drank and I would be throwing up. I was like 98 pounds soaking wet. I had an afro long before afros became popular. I mean, I was just a regular mess. And I'm in the hospital, and this girl on the other side of me had sickle cell anemia. One on the other side of me had some other, and I'm only in there for drinking. This has been about my eighth hospitalization, and I'm in there, tubes coming down my throat and everything. I comes out of the hospital. I get this call from my sister-in-law, who I couldn't stand with a passion, okay? But she was one. She works for David Dinkins and Percy Sutton, and she was very civic-minded and lived in Co-op City, and she calls me on the phone and tells me, well, I could get you some help for that problem. And I'm looking at the phone. I'm saying, now, what problem she talking about, you know? But anyway, my husband was on the other end. He said, dial that number. And all he had to do was look at me by then. He said, dial the damn number. I dialed the number, and the woman on the other end said, Alcoholics Anonymous, may I help you? And I looked at the phone. I thought I had the wrong number. I didn't know how you may. I thought, you know, I said, damn, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, my version of an alcoholic was somebody with some long bed eating out of the garbage pail on Skid Row or in the Bowery. I didn't consider myself to be no alcoholic. We drove a Cadillac. I had a little wrap that I thought was mink, but it really was a skunk. And, you know, and we was stepping out and we was big time this and big time that, you know, all up and down Harlem and whatnot. I said, me an alcoholic? I'm not no alcoholic. And just like my friend here said, this is my problem. That's my problem. But anyway, my husband said, you dialing the number. So the woman on the other end asked me if I could make a meeting that night. And I had to, he said he didn't give a damn whether it was AA, BB, or CC. I was getting up out of there. So he said, you getting up out of here, you going to a meeting tonight. A woman named Rita, and I go very few places. I don't go, in fact, I don't go any place and not call Rita's name. She's now made her transition. But if it wasn't for her coming, picking me up, taking me to various meetings, I would not be here today. Now, Rita, as I know Rita to be, as I am too, we always late for everything. So I'm sitting there waiting. I'm dressing down now. I'm putting on all black and no makeup. And I said, you got me going with these bums. And I don't know where. We'll say, I don't give a shit. You going. I went there, and I sat on the first row, and I heard a man who's got to have about 45, 50 years now, a guy named Gene. And Gene talked about drinking Sterno and being on the chain gang out in L.A. and this, that, and drinking. And I went home, and I told Whip, my husband's name was Whip, I said, that shit is better than the Apollo. I said, you should hear them. I said, man, these people are talking about doing this and doing that and whatever. And we said, well, did anybody say anything to you about your drinking? I said, ain't nobody said nothing to me about no drinking. He said, well, what do you mean they ain't said nothing? Did they tell you what you got to do to stop drinking? None of us knew anything about AA. We didn't. I had no concept of Alcoholics Anonymous at all. He said, well, I told him, I said, well, maybe you go there for a while, and after a while they give you two drinks, and they see how you do with the two, and then you go back, and they give you another three, and then you do good with that, and then you go. And then I said, oh, shit, if they do that, I'll go, you know. I said, that's right up my alley, you know. So I'm sitting in the meeting. I'm going out. I'm waiting for Rita. I'm ready to go. I'm saying, now, when am I going to get my two drinks, you know, because I couldn't drink no more in the house. And I'm waiting and waiting. I'm going to meetings. And the people are coming to me. They're kissing me on the cheek a day at a time, introducing themselves to me, this, that, and the other. And I got tired of all that. You know what I mean? I didn't sit up front with the winners and first things first and this, that, and the other. And I said, I was too scared to say something out because it must have been about maybe 10 people in the room at that time. I said, well, I wonder when they're going to give me something to drink, when they're going to start teaching me how to drink. I must have went to the meeting for maybe about a month or so, and ain't nobody gave me shit, you know. So I said, I come back from the meeting, and I told this lady that I was walking up to catch the bus with, I eased up beside her. And I said, well, miss, I said, do you know when they're going to start, you know, giving out, you know, a few drinks here and there and whatnot, you know, and when we gone. She said, what? And this woman's name is Beth. This woman don't bite her tongue. What? You don't get nothing to drink in here? Blah, 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 blah. This is the day of the dime program. What you talking about? Blah, 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 blah. I said, you mean you all never drink? She said, no. I went home. I told Whip. I said, ain't no point in me going back there. I said, what am I going back there for? Whip said, you mean nobody in there ever drinks? I said, no. He said, well, ain't no point in you going back there because they can't do nothing with you. They're not going to stop you from drinking. And so I stopped coming. But alcoholism kept happening. I made more detoxes. I had more trouble. I had alcoholic myopathy. I'm so grateful today to be able to stand up because there was a time when I couldn't walk. There was a time when he had to carry me from one room to the other. There was a time when I was drinking so terribly that I had to be sit. He had to sit me on the toilet bowl for me to go to the bathroom because my legs would not hold me up. And I was like 70 pounds or 60 pounds soaking wet. I couldn't eat. I couldn't hold anything in my hand. I kept drinking. I went back and forth, back and forth. And then finally, see, I wasn't one of these people, and I go to many, many AA meetings, and I hear people say, I landed in the rooms, or some bell went off, or something touched me, or higher power, or this, that. I sat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I shook. I threw up. In those days, people used to fall out. People used to fall right out in the meetings, and they would give you a pint. We always had a pint of alcohol somewhere around to give people because they would just pass out. And I was one of those people. I am so grateful today that that life that I lived at that time no longer exists in my life. I am so grateful to be here. If I never speak at another AA meeting again in life, as long as I'm able to come, as long as I'm able to hear people like my friend, as long as I'm able to see your smiling faces, I'm in seventh heaven. I don't need anything else. Now, I've gotten a lot, but I don't need anything other than you looking at me, and I love you. And the reason I know that you love me is because I love you. You see, I may never see any of you again. At the end of, come Sunday, we'll all go our different ways. We'll all go back to our own home groups and our own lives. But we have something here. See, we have something here that churches don't have, that other organizations don't have, that our families don't have. You see, when I see somebody with one of these tags on, I automatically smile. and they automatically smile at me. And that's love. And that's all we need. And that is what has got me here today, 33 years later. You see, I don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to necessarily make friends. I am a friend because I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I end my talks, wherever I am, I always say, how do you repay somebody for giving you your life? What dollar figure do you put on your life being saved? I don't know. I don't know how much to give you for saving my life. So the only thing I could do when somebody calls, and I don't know who called me, and somebody said, we would like for you to speak at the convention, the word is yes. The word is love. So thank you so much for being a part of my life today. God bless you.
Thank you very much, Evelyn. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our third speaker, and that's Butch M. from Ontario. Let's give him a warm welcome.
My name is Butch Maslin. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I want to thank the committee and our General Service Office for giving me the opportunity and privilege of coming here and taking part in our 70th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I say that to you, I'm not saying it because it sounds nice or I want you to like me. I'm saying it because I mean it from the very bottom of my heart. I consider it a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I consider it a privilege to come here and be with you people. And I want to thank you for the opportunity of taking part in this glorious event. I want to thank both our speakers for a lovely, lovely AA messages. I'll tell you, I hope I don't ever have to return to drinking, but if I do, I'm hooking up with someone like Evelyn for sure. You're my kind of alcoholic. I want to thank my Debbie for all the support and sacrifices that she makes so I'm able to come here and be active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean that from the depth of my soul. Thank you. I'm a member of the Tuesday night Collier Street group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Tuesday nights. And if you're ever in Barrie, we'd love to see you there. I want to thank, I don't know about any of you, I'm sure none of you alcoholics are like this, but I from time to time can become a little self-centered. I know you don't identify with that, and it's very easy for me to go to roundups and conferences and things like that and come here on a Thursday or Friday and enjoy our dances and our fellowship and these wonderful meetings and just have an incredible time and get on in my car on Sunday and drive home and sometimes forget all the hard work that has been done on our behalf. Because there has been people. There has been people who've taken time out of their lives, some of them now over a period of years. There has been people who've left their homes and their families many, many nights for committee meetings. And there's been many, many people who will not get to take in really very much of this convention at all because they'll be out there in those hallways and places greeting and welcoming people like you and I. And I thank those people from the bottom of my heart because they are truly the giants. I'm going to talk quick. I mentioned I'm a member of the Tuesday night Collier Street group, and I'm a group guy. I believe in the home group. I believe it is one of the greatest commitments that I can make in Alcoholics Anonymous to my group. And I try to be an active and a committed member to my group. And I'm very fortunate. I'm one of those people, a little bit unlike Evelyn. From the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was something here for me. I think it is very different for all of us. We all have different journeys. But I was one of those guys that came here almost from the beginning. Almost from the beginning. And so I've enjoyed Alcoholics Anonymous almost from day one. I like meetings. I like roundups, conventions, assemblies. I've loved everything about it. But I'll tell you what I love most of all. Group night. Huh? Group night. And I've had two groups since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. The Friday night with Sega Beach Step and Tradition Group is my first group. And when I moved to Barrie, I still kept that group for 2 years. And then I felt I should belong to a group in the community where I lived, and I joined the Collier Street group. But I'll tell you, I used to go to my home group. I'd wake up on Friday mornings. I'd be excited. I'd be excited Friday mornings. And I'd go to work, and the guys at work, they'd tease with me because they know something's happened to me by now for sure. And they'd say to me, "Hey, Butch, group night, huh?" And I'd have a grin from ear to ear, and I'd say, "Group night." And I'd go to my home group on a Friday night, and I want to tell you, all my troubles don't vanish. Everything doesn't go away, but I go there, and I feel better. And I was sitting around in my group once on a Friday night. It was a discussion meeting, and it came around to my turn, and I wasn't trying to be profound. I said, "You know something?" I said, "I think I'm the luckiest guy in the whole wide world." I said, "I think I'm the luckiest guy in the world." I said, "And if you gave me the ability tonight to be anywhere in the world you want to be, Butch, anywhere, French Riviera, Swiss Alps, Las Vegas, Paris, you name it, kid, you can be anywhere in the world you want to be." I said, "There's no place I'd rather be than right here in this meeting." Lady next to me said, "You've gone too far this time, Butch." She said, "I can think of a lot of places I'd rather be than an AA meeting." And I had no qualms with that statement. There was a time in my life I could have thought of a few places I'd rather be than an AA meeting. Having a root canal would have been one. Anyway, I want to share a little story with you that I often share, and I think it's appropriate at the topic that we're talking about today, that if you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous or you are struggling in alcoholics, it may help you understand why I felt that way that night and I feel that way today. It was a story that my sponsor shared with me, a true story. Well, I hope my whole story is true, but that part is for sure. True story happened many, many years ago. There was a fellow in Western Canada who was brand new to Alcoholics Anonymous. He was only sober a couple of months, and his job was going to transfer from across the country to Ontario, not that far from here. And he went home, and he discussed it with his wife and that. They had two little daughters, and they agreed that he was going to accept the transfer and move his family across the country. So they took that move, and they transferred a couple thousand miles across the country, and the fellow settled into his job. And to his credit, as soon as he got there, he looked up Alcoholics Anonymous in the book, and he started to go to AA meetings. And he was in his new job and going to some meetings, and he'd been here a couple of months, and there was a car accident, and his wife was killed, 24 years old. The fella didn't have any family or anything here, and he made a decision that he was going to have a funeral service here, and then he was going to take his wife's body back out west to bury her. And in those days, they traveled by train. It was a long time ago. So he went to his AA group, and he asked six of the guys in the group if they would act as pallbearers for this funeral service and to see the coffin to the train, which they agreed to do. They had that funeral service, and the coffin was taken to the train station, and the six AA guys were there as the coffin was loaded on, and this fellow boarded the train with his two little girls for a two-day trip out west to bury his wife, absolutely heartbroken. 2 days later, in a little town in Western Canada, that train pulled into the station, and that fellow got off the train onto the platform with his two little girls in hand. And there, standing on the platform waiting, was the same six AA guys. They'd taken time from their jobs. Some of them had borrowed money. They flew out west and rented a car and were waiting at that little station when that guy got there. Just wanted them to know AA was with them. I ask you, why would I want to be anywhere else in the world but with people like you? Huh? I like to drink. I don't know about any of you people. I think sometimes in AA you'd think it's sacrilegious to say you like to drink. I love drinking. I loved everything about drinking. I liked drinking when I wasn't even drinking. I love watching drinking on TV. Huh? I did. I'd watch those commercials on TV. I love watching those commercials. I don't know if you ever saw it. I'd see that commercial. They'd show that bottle of beer in the summertime and the condensation running down it. Oh, and then they'd take that cab and go, and that little puff of smoke would come out. I'd head right for the fridge, I saw that. I did. My favorite was, they used to, they had a beer commercial. It was the boys going away for the weekend. I always wanted to be one of the boys. And it showed the boys that were going into this private lake fishing for the weekend. They were in a little airplane. And it showed this plane circling the lake, and it was very early in the morning, and the lake was just like glass, and the mist was coming off it. Oh, it was beautiful. And this plane, it lands on the lake, and it just glides along the water, and it glides up to the dock. And the boys, they get off the airplane, and six of them go walking down the dock with one case of beer. That should have been my clue right there. And then it flashes to the night scene. The boys have been out on the lake fishing, and now they're sitting around the campfire having a Molson Golden. Well, let me tell you, when I went fishing, we took dynamite. We took a case of vodka, and the first guy that passed out, we'd stick his feet in the fire, see how long it took him to wake up. It never quite worked for me the way it did on the TV. I love that drinking. I love that lifestyle. I started to drink at a very early age. I don't know, as Evelyn, about dysfunctional families. Was my family dysfunctional? I don't know. Let me just tell you, it wasn't the Cleaver residence around my home. There was a lot of parties in my home, a lot of drinking in my home on weekends and stuff. And I was a little wee boy, and they let me play bartender. And I could take them drinks and take away the empties, and I could have swigs. And they'd say, "Isn't he cute?" And I love that attention. I love that. So I started to drink when I was 4 years old. Now, I wasn't a daily drinker when I was four. My allowance wouldn't allow it. I actively sought out alcohol. Maybe I was 12 years old. I got a guy to go into a liquor store, give us a couple bottles of wine. I was going to be a wine connoisseur. Let me just tell you, any wine I drank had a cap, not a cork. We drank that wine, got drunk, puked, and passed out, and that was the end of my social drinking. It was all downhill after that. I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous say things like they came to AA hoping to learn how to become social drinkers. Hoped AA was going to teach them how to drink socially. I want to tell you this afternoon, I didn't want to be a social drinker when I drank. I don't want to be a social drinker today. I don't particularly like social drinkers. I find them weird. They let the ice melt in their drink. That's sick drinking. That's alcohol abuse. Huh? I'm a barroom drinker. I don't identify with closet alcoholics. You know, you hear them, they get the bottle, went in the room, locked the door, put on the hurt music. Don't identify with them. Doesn't mean they're not alcoholics, just drank differently than me. I'm a barroom drinker. I love bars. I like opening the door to a bar. Ah, that smoke it billow out, that tinkle of glass. I like neon. I like neon. I liked it when I was drinking. I still like it. That's why I stay out of those casinos. They're not good places for guys like me. And I thank God, Evelyn, I never tried to get sober in the United States of America. I don't think it ever made it. I love you. I love drinking there. I love those little places. I call them what you did, juke joints. You know those divey little bars you'd see? Those divey little corner bars with a little neon sign outside? Says cocktails. Oh, huh? Debbie and I, we were on our way to Pennsylvania one time, an AA thing, and we drove, and I'm going through this little wee town in the middle of nowhere. And I'm driving down the main street. I hammer on the brakes to my car. I'm backing the car up. She says, "Butch, what are you doing?" I said, "I got to see this again." And there it was, a divey little juke joint with a neon sign. Said, "Stop for one, stay till one." If I'd have been drinking, I'd have had that tattooed on me. Beautiful. Beautiful. Huh? We have some laughs with our drinking, don't we? Huh? And we're supposed to. It tells me in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I read the stories of our earliest members, how what attracted them was the way these people seemed to be able to laugh at themselves and enjoy life, and were supposed to laugh. But I don't want to leave anybody here with the impression it was all just one big party out there. It was all just one good time, because there was a lot of people got hurt at my expense. See, I don't have to look back very far in my mind's eye to see the face of an 18-year-old friend lying dead beside the car. and taking them to the hospital and dropping them at the front door and getting out so nobody gets busted. He died of an overdose of dope and booze. And I don't have to remember very back. In my mind's eye, I see the face of an 18-year-old friend who put a gun in her mouth and blew her head off because she couldn't stand the way she felt anywhere and didn't know where to go. And I don't have to think back very far in my mind's eye to see the face of my mother and father and the tears streaming down their face with their 17-year-old kid saying, "We're not going to have Christmas this year, Butch. We're waiting till you get out of this jail." It wasn't all just fun and games. As I look back, I was 25 years old. By now, I'm living in stairwells. I had a new address every night. I just moved from building to building. You'll hear people in AA talk about the AA luggage, matching green garbage bags. I didn't have any AA luggage. I had the clothes on my back. Still had an ultra suede jacket, though. Had to be cool at any expense. If I was any cooler, I'd have froze to death. I'm 25 years old. I'm living in stairwells and stuff. My wife had thrown me out of our home, and nobody wanted anything to do with me, nor should they. Because alcoholics are takers. We're users. And we use and take from the people who love us most till we use them up and they can't stand being around us anymore. And that's the condition I was in at 25 years old. And I'm out one night, and I'm all jacked up. I don't have anywhere to live, and that ex-wife of mine, we had a house. And I remember a screened-in porch down in the beaches of Toronto. A number of people here know what I'm talking about, with some wicker couches on it. I thought, I'll slip in there and grab a couple hours and get out before she wakes up in the morning. Well, I passed out, and I didn't wake up, and I wake up to one of these. And I opened my eyes and looked, and there was that ex-wife of mine, and she looked at me with disgust and pity. And she said, "Butch, you're a useless piece of scum, and you're never going to change. And if you care anything about me, you will get up and get out of here, and please don't ever come back. Because I can't stand to look at you the way you are." I get up and I left there and I went down to what they call the boardwalk down on the water in Toronto. And it was a July or August day and it was hot and I was sick and I was heartsick. And I went and I sat down on a little bench down there and there was a little boy on a bench across from me, 6 or 7 years old, eating a popsicle. And you know what I thought to myself? I wish I had a dime for a popsicle. The big shot. The big wheeler dealer, the guy in the bar buying everybody's drinks, all finished, all washed up. And here's the thought that I had. I knew at that moment that that's as good as my life was ever going to be. Now, I knew I'd put a deal together. I've always been a talker and a hustler and schemer. I knew I'd put something together. But I knew at that moment that that's as good as my life was ever going to get. And I knew it. I was 25 years old. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and you people on September the 21st, 1989, however many years later, seven or eight years later. And you and I know it never gets better out there. It only gets worse. And I had 8 more years on those streets. And I came to you people on September the 21st, and I never had any intentions of staying, didn't know I was going to stay, but I arrived here with you. And you people told me that you had a program here, that you had a set of principles. If I practiced them as a way of life, would expel the necessity for me to drink alcohol and allow me to live happily and usefully whole. What a deal. You see, I don't know about you, but all I ever wanted, when all that mayhem was going on in my life, when my mom and dad sat in that jail, when my wife sat at home not knowing where I was, when all that stuff was going on, all I ever wanted was to be okay. That's all I ever wanted. And you people told me you had a program if I practiced as a way of life. Would allow me to live happily and usefully whole. I have a deep love in my heart for the old-timers of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm looking so forward to our meeting on Saturday night with the old-timers. A deep, deep love for men and women who've been coming for 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 years, who've made sacrifices and commitments to Alcoholics Anonymous so it would be here for people like you and I. I love them from the very depth of my soul. And if you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would urge you to get close to these men and women, because we're not going to have them with us forever. And I had some wonderful people come into my life, none more than my own sponsor, Bobby Dobson. Giants. I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous say, "You can't put people on pedestals." Well, you do what you want. But I'll tell you something. I have some people on pedestals. Giants of men and women. Never for a moment have I lost sight of their humanities. You know the greatest gift the old-timers have ever given me? The greatest thing my sponsor ever did for me is you've allowed me to see your humanities. You've allowed me to see your mistakes. You've allowed me to see you be wrong. You've allowed me to see all this. Because if you hadn't, I'd never measure up. I would never measure up. And you introduced me to a life beyond anything I've ever, ever known. I was at a conference. I was 6 months sober, and my sponsor took me to a conference. We went to this conference, and we were downstairs early in the morning, and my sponsor, a lot of you people here knew, but there was a kindness and gentleness and love about that man that was incredible. People were just attracted to him, and many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. You just wanted to be around him. And we met a fellow there. We were having coffee and smoking and talking to this guy, and he was, you could tell he was attracted to Bob, and he asked if he could go to breakfast with us. Well, he went to breakfast with us. And then after breakfast, he said, do you mind if I join you for the meetings? And he came to the meetings with us. And then he said, do you mind if I join you for lunch? And he came to lunch with us and at the night meetings. And the next morning, he was I think if we'd have said we're going to go slit our throat, he'd have joined us. But I understand today what it was. So he spent the weekend with us, and it was on Sunday, and we took on the last meeting, and we come out, and he came up to us, and the tears, he started crying his eyes out. And he said, I don't know what to say. I love you guys. I don't want to leave you. And my sponsor and I, we were walking to the car. And as we were walking to the car, I stopped and I started to cry. And I looked at my sponsor and I said, Bobby, I said, this is what it's all about, isn't it? And he knew what was happening. He said to me, kid, I want to tell you something. You might not understand. But he said, if you stay here and you keep doing the things you're doing, you are going to live a life beyond your wildest dreams. Huh? Beyond our wildest, wildest dreams. So much you do for us. Gratitude. Am I grateful? And what am I grateful for? I want to tell you today that I am extremely grateful just to be grateful. Because before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was never grateful a single solitary day in my life. No matter what I had, it was never enough. I always wanted more or different. Never knew the meaning of gratitude. And I'll tell you today, every single thing in my life that is good is because of you people. Everything that in my life I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous and people like you. One last little story and I'll finish up. You gave me the note. I'm going to finish here. That sponsor of mine, we had a long, long time and such an incredible life together. And my sponsor was starting to get older, and his health was starting to decline greatly. And he was on oxygen all the time, and he couldn't walk anymore. We had to take him by wheelchair. And we were going to a meeting last June the 8th, and he was in not very good shape by then. And I phoned him up and said, Bobby, I said, maybe we better not go to that meeting tonight. He said, oh, kid, he said, that girl's getting her one-year birthday. We have to go. So I went and I picked him up, and he had his oxygen tanks and that. I got tanks, I got hoses, I got wheelchairs, I got more stuff in this truck than the paramedics have. I load him in there, and we drive a few hours to the meeting, and we get all this stuff out. There's no wheelchair access, but the boys, he's sitting in the wheelchair. They're carrying him in there. We're hooking up tanks and hoses and stuff. We got them all up there at the front of the room. And I'll tell you, my sponsor gave a talk beyond anything I've ever heard. He gave it all. And at the end of that meeting, he was done. And we got him, and we loaded all the stuff up, and we got him in the truck, and he and I headed up the highway. And he said to me, kid, he said, I'm awfully glad you were with me tonight. Well, we were always together. We went everywhere together. And I said, well, I'm glad I was with you too, Bob. He said, no, kid, he said, I'm really glad you were with me tonight. He said, I think I just gave my last talk. And we guys said, oh, Bobby, you're just tired. And I got him home, and I got all the stuff upstairs and all the tanks. And he said, do you have a few minutes before you go? I said, as long as you want, Bobby. He said, I want to take a look in my journal. Now, for you that don't know, my sponsor spoke at about 100 AA meetings a year and did so for 45 years. And he looked in the journal, and he said to me, Butch, he says, the journal's empty. There's nothing in place. And I went home, and I left him. And I called the next day and talked to him and stuff. We talked on the phone, and the next day, on June the 10th, AA's birthday, I phoned him about 7 o'clock at night, and the phone didn't answer. And I knew. And it was 7 o'clock, and I couldn't go. I couldn't go to the house. And it took me 2 hours. And I finally got a guy sponsor. I said, come on, we got to go to the old man's house. He said, what's up? I said, he's gone. He said, how do you know? I said, because it's June 10th, and the book is empty. And we got into that condo, and I went in, and there was that little man that I loved as much as life itself. And he was kneeling beside his bed, and he was gone. June the 10th, AA's birthday. He had given his entire life to this. Am I grateful? Am I grateful? Everything that I have in my life is because of you. And I went home, and I'll tell you, my heart was broken because I knew there was a part of my life that would never be the same. Oh, it's good. It will be good, and I have you people. But there was a part that was over, and I knew it had never been the same. And I got home that night, and I went up beside my dad after a long cry, and I thanked God for another day of sobriety. You see, my friends, Alcoholics Anonymous works in the good times, and it works in the bad times. Alcoholics Anonymous works all the time. In those darkest hours when we think we can't go on, these men and women will pick us up, and they'll carry us through. You see, God didn't take Bobby from us. He gave him to us for 45 years. What a wonderful gift we've had. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity and privilege of being here this weekend. I want to thank you ladies for a lovely AA message, for your kindness and patience. And you know, I don't know what's going to happen from here on in, and none of us do for sure, do we? You see, just because we get sober and become members of Alcoholics Anonymous, life doesn't stop happening. People die. Relationships end. Businesses fail. People get sick. But I'll tell you something. Every single morning for some time now, I say to my friend upstairs in the morning, I say, if you see fit, I sure would appreciate it if you keep me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, my dear friends, there is no place in this whole world I'd rather be than right here with you fine people. Thank you, and God bless.
Thank you, Butch. We've had the pleasure today to really hear three wonderful speakers talk about the transforming nature of this program, and I think all of us have a great deal to be grateful for if we remember that 70 years ago today, this program started when one alcoholic figured out the way to stay sober was to try to help another alcoholic. And as a result, today, there are probably more sober people in this room than there existed in the world at that time. So I think it would be altogether fitting if we could end this meeting with the responsibility pledge that we take to one another. I am responsible when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA always to be there, and for that, I am responsible.